I'd like to call the meeting today of the House Resources Committee to order. Today is January 19th, 2024. We are located in the Alaska State Capitol, Room 124. Members present are Representative Mears, Representative Armstrong by phone. Can you hear me all right, Representative Armstrong?
I hear you loud and clear. Thank you, Chairman Hayes.
Okay, very good. And then Representative Dyber is here, Representative McCabe, Representative Sadler, Representative Wright, Representative Baker, Representative Rauscher, and myself, Chairman Tom McKay. So we do have a quorum to do business. I do not see any other legislators in the audience. I'd like to thank the staff today, David, Linda, and Zach, for helping us with the technology, and remind everyone, including myself, to make sure your cell phones are on silent. So today, we will have a presentation from the DNR. That's our only topic for today. And my goal is for us to get an update on how the projects we discussed last year have progressed. Members, please note that a few changes were made to the slides after they were printed. The numbers on the screen are correct. Thank goodness. Joining us today is Deputy Commissioner John Crowther, Director Derek Nottingham from the Division of Oil and Gas, Director Melanie Worden from the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. So thank you all for coming down to Juneau and welcome back to House Resources. Please come forward to the table, state your name for the record, and begin your presentation.
Well, thank you, Chair McKay. For the record, this is Deputy Commissioner John Crowther of the Department of Natural Resources. Very much appreciate your and the committee's time to hear today an update on both our oil and gas and mining projects and developments, and a little bit about an outlook in both of those important sectors. So great to be before the committee. I won't do too much further introduction just because we have a lot of slides to go through, but on a general matter, in both these sectors, we're seeing a positive trend. We view that as due to kind of some global and macro factors, demand for commodities, interest, but it's also specific, we think, to oil and gas, in large part due to our geologic prospectivity, both for oil and gas and for our mineral resources, and just for the overall advancing of technology, the continuous improvement we see in these sectors, and that's allowing us to assess and unlock new frontiers that we think will be have a significant contribution to long-term productive activity in the future of our state. So with that, I'll turn it over to our director of our Division of Oil and Gas to get started on that presentation.
Yes, so for the record, I'm Derek Nottingham, director of the Division of Oil and Gas, and Chairman Gay, it is an honor to present to the committee today on, as John mentioned, very exciting times in the oil and gas industry in Alaska. Very positive year. Over the last 365 days, we've seen Willow move forward through lots of litigation issues to FID and moving on to into the construction phase. We've seen PICA move forward. They're drilling wells now and they're breaking ground on their construction phases and facilities. So lots of exciting things going on, and it's our pleasure to update you. Just to start off with, I want to talk about the North Slope potential in general. To date, 18.9 billion barrels of oil have been produced from the North Slope, so lots of oil. Put that in the context for you, if we were to try to produce that at today's rate, it would take 110 years. So that's a lot of oil. There's still a lot of oil left to be discovered. Over 48 billion barrels is the estimate from various sources like USGS. There's a lot of gas on this lake as well that we know about, discovered gas, 50 trillion cubic feet. A lot of that is in the Prudhoe Bay gas cap, Point Thompson, and other areas around the slope. And there's still quite a bit of undiscovered conventional gas and unconventional gas, upwards of 300 TCF. It's hard to get your head around that number, but lots of gas. And as John mentioned, we've seen very positive trends over the last couple of years steady and high in North Slope activity coming out of COVID and low oil prices, those kind of things. The investment is definitely pointing to a bright future. A lot of that's to do with the stable fiscal environment. We've seen recent finds on state lands that, you know, demonstrate great potential, like the Nanushuk formations, Torah formations, Brookian exploration in general that is really picking up, not only in the areas that we hear about most, but we'll see in a future slide, like on the eastern slope, we're seeing exploration activity there in that Brookian section. The legacy fields, such as Prudhoe Bay, Melanie Point, Park, all continue to do well, exceeding their initial expectations, stabilizing decline. There's to maintain the production rates in those fields, there's always a lot of infill work. We're seeing the operators in those fields, Conoco, Hillcorp, doing near infrastructure type of exploratory work and development to bring on new pools and those kind of things. So there's really a lot of work going on in those legacy fields. I can't say enough about what we've seen happen at Millie Point. If you get a chance to take a look, when I was working at BP, a good day of production at Millie Point was around 20,000 barrels a day. Hillcorp is hoping to possibly hit 50,000 barrels a day in that field. So they've really done an excellent job of redeveloping that field since that field went over, and very positive news from Millie Point. This slide really illustrates and just kind of sets the context where that 18.9 billion barrels of oil has come from. When you look at the slide, the numbers are in billions of barrels of oil, so that 18.9 billion barrels of oil was 18,883 million barrels of oil. The lion's share of that, as you can see from the map, from the Prudhoe Bay, Kapari, Colville, River units, 14 billion barrels of oil from Prudhoe, closing in on 3 billion barrels of oil from Kapari, 640 million from the Colville River. And these are the units that we actively manage. We review plans of development from each one of the operators pretty much on an annual basis to ensure that they're continuing to develop their assets and really managing those reservoirs, those pools in a prudent manner. And then the hatched units that you can see are the ones that haven't been on production yet. We also manage those to ensure that those operators are moving towards moving their projects towards production in an expedient manner.
Representative McCabe has a question.
Yeah, so as long as we're talking about non-producing fields, I think I am, and this committee is probably going to be intensely interested in West Harrison Bay and why Shell is violating their time period of their lease and why we are allowing it. This smacks of Point Thompson and why we allowed for so long that field to go undeveloped. I understand there's two companies up there, Narwhal and Shell, right? And what are we doing with that? Why is that just kind of dormant? And in fact, I do not understand that Shell does not intend to ever participate in the North Slope again. So what are we doing with that particular lease?
Representative McCabe, through the chair, John Trevor, Deputy Commissioner here. I'll speak just a little bit quickly to the leasing unit history there, and also some of the important context about Shell status with that unit, and then a little bit about how the department going forward is doing this. As you mentioned, Director Nottingham mentioned, expedient development is critical, and we believe that applies to West Harrison Bay as well. So for the West Harrison Bay, the leases comprising that unit, I believe, date back to the early 2010s. So in about the 2012 timeframe is, there was some leasing activity before that, but the current lease is about a decade old as of the beginning of this decade. And Shell brought forward a unitization application, I believe in 2020, that was granted. That unit agreement, the contract between the state and the operator, had a number of requirements for Shell and a time period for performance up to 2025. There was some of the commitments in that agreement. Shell sought modification and adjustment from the department, which at the time the department granted. At that time period, 2020-2021, limitations from COVID, limitations from the kind of larger investment climate. But those obligations under that unit agreement are coming due. And we in the department view the existing obligations as significant and important. There's a certain number of those obligations that I mentioned that have been requested to be modified. Shell has also made a request to the department to extend that lease period or the unit period for performance. We're evaluating that request right now. I will say that there are a couple of factors that are influencing the department's decision. We could be happy to speak with yourself or the committee members in more detail about. But one of the things that we look at is the broader environment for investment and development. Across the slope, we're seeing investors who want to spend money in Alaska and developers who want to grow wealth. And so any adjustment to our commitments are going to be in light of those important factors and pulling those forward so that wells are drilled sooner and the investment occurs. Or, you know, any unit agreement is a contract, so there's obligations and for both parties. But if Shell wants us to modify or extend those deadlines, we expect significant commitments to development, and it's entirely possible that those extensions may not be granted. So it's an important area of the slope. We're looking very closely at it. The department, we're actively trying to work with all the operators and all the interested parties. We'll certainly continue to do so. I would, you know, finally note the department can't at all speak for Shell or for any other operator, but we do continue to see a positive trend. You know, many investors, different development companies made statements about they're not planning to invest in Alaska, do business in Alaska, but we have seen both formally through formal announcements and also through the development of different positions they're staking out, that they're starting to realize the resources are very significant, environmental protections are very high, community support is high, and that those things may be consistent with their corporate strategy. So we're, for any operator, we're going to, any statement that says we're not going to do business in Alaska, we're going to be pushing back on that. And any commitment to do business under existing union agreement, we're going to push really hard to make sure that's on schedule. And if there's concessions, the department also gets significant benefit for the state capital.
Thanks, I appreciate that, and you can add our push behind you. Our constitutional mandate as legislators is to develop the resources for all Alaskans, and to hear a company that owns a significant find, maybe a huge find, through their leases in West Harrison Bay, say that they are not going to do business in Alaska is disheartening at best, and we cannot allow another Point Thompson where the lease lies fallow for years, and a resource that belongs to Alaskans just because a company decides that whatever reason they don't want to do business is underutilized. We have got to find ways to motivate them. So if we can help as a legislature, as a committee, I think we intend to do that. So I appreciate that.
Thank you, Representative McKay. We hear you loud and clear, sir.
So I'll make a comment. We've been considering having a hearing with Shell and Narwhal and the DNR to come forward and explain on the public record the history of this lease and unit and why several extensions have been granted and why we don't have an exploratory well or wells already in progress. So it's very much on our mind, and we may have a hearing to address that. Representative Rauscher, you had a question?
Yes, thank you. To the chair, I was just wondering, you said that they were asking for an extension. How long was the extension?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, John Crowley here again. The requested extension was for a 2-year period, and that was a request of the department. The department has not concluded any additional extension or granted any extension. And as I mentioned, that would be a negotiation between both parties, with obligations for both parties, were there to be an extension granted.
To the chair, so that was just a request, just for 2 extra years?
That was the initial request.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any other questions at this point? We probably need to keep moving. Representative Wright has to go to another hearing, so please continue, Mr. Nottingham.
Representative Nottingham again. This map shows the working interest ownership of our units and the breakdown of the different companies. I will point out to you of importance from a production and revenue standpoint, Prudhoe Bay, the ownership is varied. ExxonMobil is a large owner. Conoco is a large owner. Hillcorp, the operator, is obviously a large owner, but a minority owner. And so that's one aspect here that for the committee to keep in mind as you consider where the production comes from is Hillcorp may be operating Prudhoe Bay, but the other owners are a significant portion of the investment and the production there. A couple other things to point out. You may have heard that the Southern Maluvich unit, or more commonly known as Mustang, has recently been sold to Finex. So they are now the operator. That unit is still under the name, the formal company name of Mustang Holding. So you don't see a change there, but that ownership has changed. And then a couple other things to point out. The operator of the Dominion Savant, Glacier Oil, they have undergone some restructuring, new owners, new partners in their unit in Badami. They're also going to become the operator of record of the Gray Owl unit. So there's a lot of changes that are actually going on that aren't really reflected in the ownership map here that are impactful to the activity sets that we'll see in the next slide. This is the slide that may not be exactly what you have in your packet. This is a slight change from the packet that you were given. It still represents the basic gist of activity that is going on the North Slope. From the west side, Conoco Phillips obviously actively developing Willow and moving forward. Santos, as I mentioned earlier, drilling and doing construction work as we speak. ConocoPhillips in their existing producing units, still doing quite a bit of near infrastructure, exploratory development type work, where they're developing the Toroq PA or the Toroq formation, and moving plans forward to drill quite a few wells and add infrastructure there. Hillcorp, as I mentioned, is very active in the Lindy Point and plan to drill and build and drill the Reagan pad, or known as R pad, in the next year. And then, as I mentioned, also moving out towards the east, Savant or Glacier, they are drilling their first well in quite a while. Since I think around 2017, 2018 timeframe, the B133, and so they're expecting to split that well in the near future. And then, very exciting news, we have a slide coming up on it. Lenyap, Alaska, or basically Armstrong Oil and Gas, they are executing a 3-well exploration program out on the eastern slope, south of the Dominion. They'll execute those 3 wells this year and then another 3 next year as a plan. And so we're looking very much forward to what they're going to find and what they assess there. And then last but not least, towards the bottom there, Accumulate Energy. They drilled their Hickory 1 well in the 2-inch unit last year, and they're going to get back out to that well this year and frack it, flow test it, and kind of understand what the fluids there are, what kind of production rates they're in. See about that. On this slide, we have an update on the key North Slope projects. Pico mentioned they're moving forward to first oil, which is anticipated in the middle of 2026. That's expected to bring on around 80,000 barrels of oil a day in their phase one development. Willow, obviously, we mentioned that as well. The record of decision on the EIS was came in last year. Construction activity started in April 2023, and then they announced their final investment decision just last month. So moving forward, a lot of the legal hurdles and legal risks have been mitigated, but still some to go there, but Conoco did go ahead and move forward with their FID in the past month. Peak rate expected to be in the 2029 timeframe, or first oil expected to be in the 2029 timeframe with a peak rate of around 180,000 barrels a day. ConocoPhillips CDA development has been pushed back a couple of years due to pending stakeholder alignment, permitting, and some internal studies. That project is expected to bring on 32,000 barrels a day, but as I mentioned, it's been pushed back from 2028 to 2030. I mentioned the Raven pad that Hillcorp is bringing forward at Millie Point. That particular development is analogous to the 2018 Moose Pad development, expected to bring on around 10,000 barrels of oil a day. And then Conoco's Numitorax within the KRU is moving forward, funding provided in 2023. DNR approved the drill site, the 3T expansion activities, and first oil expected in 2025. That one is expected to come on at 20,000 barrels.
Okay. Representative Savage has a question.
Thank you, Chairman. I have. Give us an outline of the key North Slope projects. Which is the government jurisdiction? Which your state? Which your federal lands?
Through the chair, Representative Savage. So PICA is state land, a combination of state land and maybe corporation. So the state and ESRC. Willow is federal land on the NPRA. Colville River is a similar makeup as PICA, some state land, some native. Millie Point is 100% state land, and Carrier is 100% state land.
Thank you.
Okay, please continue.
This is an excerpt from our fall 2023 production forecast to update the committee on what we're forecasting for the next 10 years. Won't go into all of the detail on how this is put together, but we'll just kind of give you the high-level summary. So starting, and then I'll explain the chart just a bit. So on the left, there's oil rate forecasted from 2024 through 2033. You can see in the 2024 timeframe, that's fiscal year 2024, we're forecasting around 478,000 barrels of oil per day. And you can kind of see on this chart our official forecast, relatively flat for the next 2 years, and then building as projects like Pico come on and some of the other projects we've mentioned, and then flattening out but then building again towards the latter part of the decade as projects like Willow come on. When you compare the operator forecast to our official forecast, we're very, very close to what the operators are forecasting in 2024. But there is a difference over the next couple of years. I believe that's a difference in forecast methodology and the success of future activity sets going forward that's causing that difference. And as you go forward in the future towards the middle and latter half of the decade, you see the operator forecast lower than ours. That's because the operators don't include big projects like PICA or Willow or some of those bigger projects in their forecast. They provide the state with only what is currently under development. And it is useful to point out that we do have a high and low forecast. That high forecast towards the end of the 10-year period is looking at a very optimistic scenario where pretty much everything goes right. Over 900,000 barrels of oil a day. And on the low case, if everything goes wrong, it's very hard to do, but it can happen. Around 350,000 barrels of oil a day towards the end of the forecast there.
Well, let's hope we don't see the low.
Yeah. We are hoping.
Quite a difference between low and high.
It is. And that does illustrate the uncertainties that are just part of oil and gas development. Less uncertainty in the near term, and as time goes on, it's definitely harder to forecast what may happen. So there is a lot of uncertainty for sure.
Okay, please continue, dear.
The previous slide was the North Slope forecast. This is the statewide oil forecast. The difference in terms of the overall numbers is that the Cook is included. But what this slide is really trying to give you a hint of is our current producing fields are what we call CP on that slide on the left are doing well but will decline. And so the new projects, the what's called UE there or under evaluation, begin to play a really significant role as you get, you know, 5-10 years into the future where you're forecasting by 2023 they're the dominant factor in Alaska production, and the legacy fields have declined to a point where they're the minority in that forecast. Some of the things that you see also in this forecast is we included the spring 2023 forecast. So you see the gap between what we're forecasting now and what was forecast in spring 2023. That near-term gap is due to several things. GMT-2 is a new development out in the MPRA. There was additional drilling that was done 2022-2023 timeframe. Our expectations for those wells were not met by the actual outcomes of the wells that are produced. So they're coming in less than what we expected for them. And so there's a gap that's causing the difference between last year's forecast and this year's forecast. Also, there's also some difference in there due to our forecast for development wells and other fields maybe being a bit optimistic and the actual results coming in a little bit lower. And then the lone producer out at the Point Thompson 17 well has dropped off fairly dramatically over the last couple of years. Last year or so due to some technical productivity issues. But, you know, by and large, this is a very positive story. If you take a look at the spring 23 forecast and compare it to where we are now, or what we're forecasting now, we're roughly 60 or so thousand barrels a day above what we were forecasting, and that really is due to some of the barriers, the risks being alleviated, mitigated from projects like Pika and Willow over the last year.
Okay, continue, please.
Yeah, just a quick update on Pika. As I mentioned, we're moving forward with Santos is moving forward with drilling. They've got all the permits they need in place. They've started on major construction, pipeline, gravel, facility site preparation this year. And as I mentioned earlier, sustained production is anticipated in 2026. Phase one is they're expecting 80,000 barrels a day. Phase two, they're continuing to mature and planning for more wells that will add a substantial amount of additional production. And on the map, you can kind of see the build out of those pads towards the left hand side of the map, and kind of the roads, the new ship production facility there in the middle of the map there, and in the proximity to the Park River.
Okay, very good. We're delighted to have Santos and Pico progressing. Very great addition to our portfolio. Please continue.
Willow, the federal approvals received last year. As I mentioned, a lot of the legal challenges have been faced and favorable decisions have been reached for the development to continue. Final investment decision was in last month. The pipeline right-of-way permits have been approved, and they're moving forward. And again, that anticipated production, we're estimating somewhere in the 2029 timeframe, 180,000 barrels a day, 600 million barrels of oil estimated over the project life, and so $8 to $17 billion in royalty, property tax payments to the state, U.S., and municipal governments.
Chair McKay, for the record, John Crowther here. I would just note that the resolution from the Alaska Legislature, particularly the members of this committee, will work on that. We understand it's been tremendously influential both in the permitting process, but also in the litigation. Reference and cited by some of the courts, the judges in their rulings on the matter. So, just want to express thanks for your leadership on that, and we believe that was a very important move by the legislature to support the project, the local communities, and ultimately the state.
And thank you for those comments, Mr. Crowther. Please continue.
And as I mentioned before, there's lots of exciting work going on the Eastern North Slope. This map to the right really illustrates the exploration project that Armstrong is executing this year. As I mentioned, they are planning to drill three wells. It's the King Street 1, Voodoo 1, and Sockeye 1. You see those on the map. And then they have three other wells that they're planning to execute in 2025. So Armstrong is the operator, but they're also in partnership with Santos and Apache. It's exciting to see those companies participating in this. It's important. It's located south of the Miami unit, so there is nearby infrastructure that could be useful in the future for bringing production through. Lots of valuable information is expected to be collected this year, and this also following the trend of the map down. It was just north of the Gray Eye unit that we mentioned previously. It was just that Balcony Natural Resources is the primary owner, and Glacier Oil and Gas is going to be the operator. So you can kind of see an exciting trend starting to develop there on the eastern side. You ready to move on?
Yes.
Yeah, we're going to shift gears just a bit here and talk about the Cook Inlet. As you know, Cook Inlet is a very hot topic given the potential gas supply issues. So I want to brief the committee just a bit on Cook Inlet and what it is and how much gas has been produced, how much gas is there. So Cook Inlet, as you see from the map, really be thought of is the, you know, what I look at is it's a lot of the big arm, and that red outline kind of extends up above Talkeetna and into the Susitna Basin and that area. And you can kind of see where Andrews is on the map, and the outlines and the kind of the green and yellow there indicate where most of the existing development in the procurement are. So to date, about 12 TCM of gas has been produced out of the 15 lit and about 1.4 billion barrels of oil. To give you a bit of perspective, Cook Inlet produces around 70 BCF, 70 billion cubic feet of gas per year. So if we were just to try to produce that 12 TCF at today's rates, it would take 170 years. So there's a lot of gas, again, that's been produced out of the Cook Inlet. There's a lot of gas that remains in the Cook Inlet, but outside of the existing leases, the USGS estimates 13.7 TCF of gas, conventional gas, and 5.3 TCF of unconventional gas, so around 19, 20 TCF of potential undiscovered, but technically recoverable gas. And then in the OCS water, so outside of the state leases, kind of see where that blue arrow is pointing. Another 1.2 TCF is estimated by the by Bowman, the Bureau of Ocean Management. So the governor's legislation that was announced yesterday that targets making these prospects more economic for development.
So at the risk of slowing us down, Mr. Nottingham, has there been a lot of exploration in that Lower Cook Inlet area? You know, offhand,
there are some exploratory wells. I don't recall the number, and I don't believe any
successful.
Not necessarily successful, but I don't know that there have been any in the near or recent past.
Chairman K. John,
just curious.
Just a further answer to that. The federal waters, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, we expect that access to be extremely limited due to federal policy, and that's part of why we're focusing on the government legislation for the state hands to make those happen.
So, to follow on that statement, Mr. Crowther, you know, we see that 1.2 trillion cubic feet, and that, you know, we get excited, but what you just said was because of the federal government and your expectation that it would be difficult to access those reserves, then it's sort of off the table, right? I mean, for now, or what could change that? A change in administration in D.C. or, you know?
Yeah, Chairman Kay, I'm happy to speak to that briefly. The federal policy we've seen under this administration has been severely limited. Canceled and delayed any of the congressional mandate to hold the sale. That sale was held with limited and restrictive terms, and that the current five-year plan does not have these sales and commitments going forward. So that there's extremely limited access to those federal resources, unfortunately. But a future administration could revise that plan and make these sales available. But for our purposes today, we view the state lands and waters as directly under our control. So we want to get those as perspective as possible.
I hate to spin off a little bit further on that topic, but if we did have a change in administration and a change in policy where we could go explore the Lower Cook Inlet, could that be done with a jackup rig, you know, perhaps? Or do we need semis? I don't know the water depth down there, but I think you're still in the 200 to 300 feet water depth, I think. Yeah. I don't mean to ask you questions that you may not have studied, but you know, we need to know legally, can we get in there and drill, and what rig do we need to drill with if it happened?
Jeremy Kay, I do believe that you can get into a good portion of those areas with jackup.
Okay.
But I'm 100% confident in that.
I understand. I won't hold you to that, Darren. All right, just looking ahead, you know.
No.
Because to be perfectly honest, I think that we're, if we do, you know, we're going to have to be aggressive to find more gas in Cook Inlet unless we want to get stuck importing LNG, and everybody seems to hate that idea. So we're going to have to be aggressive, and we're going to have to move quickly. I think if we do get a change in administration and a change in federal policy, I would say as an operations type person, we need to get rolling on it, you know. Representative Mears.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I know you're not here representing the governor, but do you have any insight for us on when our package might be drafted and presented to us?
Yeah, Representative Mears, through the chair, my memory is escaping me as to the House bill number, but yesterday the governor put in a bill to work right across. It's brand new legislation just released. I believe it's House Bill.
I think it's 277.
276. 274, voice. 276. So a House bill has just been released that contains the provisions of that bill, and we'll be happy to speak in detail with the committee about it. But the provisions of that bill generally lower the royalty rate to 5% for new pools of production, whether that's an existing lease or a future lease. So we believe that would make development and several significant known prospects competitive as well as new exploration. And there's other legislation, I believe, that's been introduced focused on promoting competitiveness and development as well.
I'll just announce it. Representative Rauscher's had Bill 223, House Bill 223, that has the same general objective.
We're happy to brief the committee and work on that legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was trying to pay attention to the bills being read across a lot this week, but it's a lot to keep up with.
A lot happened.
It's a challenge for all of us, Representative. Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So, and I know, Mr. Crother, you can't clearly speak for the companies, but is that enough? Are we doing enough to attract the investment that we need to expand? Or are we going to have to consider something different, maybe an early payoff? I think Chairman King and I talked about that a little bit before, about maybe there's a better way other than just what we're doing so far. So, like I say, I know you can't speak for them, but is there a different path to go down that will help them in incentivizing development?
Representative McCabe, through the chair, I think it's a very good question and kind of at the core of this policy discussion that we're prepared to present on the legislation, the different legislation that's in front of the House. I think from our perspective, there's operators with known significant resources, and they've identified that the current royalty structure is a significant obstacle to development, obtaining financing, the returns they need to make those projects economic. So we believe it would have a material difference on the major project. It's absolutely appropriate in that discussion to look at any and all tools. We have been looking very closely with our existing authorities how we both push and pull any and all development in Cook Inlet online to get those critical gas supplies to consumers, and we'll continue to do so. But the legislature has, you know, many, many policy tools that are worth a good examination and pursuit.
Okay, Representative Sadler, and then here's
through the chair, Mr. Donahue, probably. Can you go recently some state Cook Inlet gas sales and sales? Can you characterize the results and the terms under which those leases were undertaken? So, that's what I'm here to look at.
The chair, Representative Sadler. Yes, so we offered a bit of a change in how we perform our Cook Inlet sale over in the fall. Traditionally, we would offer a 12.5% royalty rate with a bonus as kind of a bidding variable for those leases. So that's traditionally how we've done it. We have the authority through statute to offer what we call NPSL, or net profit share leases, where the state will partake in the profits of those leases once they reach payout. And so we offer with the cookie on the leases with net profit share as the bidding variable and zero royalty. And what the idea there is that we're hoping to attract companies that are looking to make their money back fairly quickly. That allows them to, you know, kind of get a higher return faster, reach payout faster, and then the state starts to share in those profits. We received six bids, three from Hillport, three from Hex. Hex, Fury, they're both current operators. For Hope in the Sea is other operators, other producers, explorers step in and bid on those leases and move forward with developments. We did not see that. And so I think that further it enhances the reason why we need to push forward other measures to incentivize development in the beginning.
And follow up, Jeff?
And when does the schedule have the next state to put in a lease sale over and the next federal lease sale?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, I'm not confident to come here and when the federal lease sale will be. We're looking at mid-2024, so in 6 months or so for the next lease sale.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, this is John Crowther. The federal government five-year leasing plan is not currently in the same yet, so for the next 5 years, if the plan proceeds that's currently in place, there will not be a federal offer of cooking leasing.
Yeah, Representative Rauscher has a question, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, about 12 or 15 years ago, Gunstein was talking about bringing oil out the gas off the slope by ship and then bring it down. And the logistics of that and what we'd have to build on the slope to make that happen. Has that been looked into any further since then? Are we even considering how the possibility of that could happen if we don't end up with a pipeline within the next 10 years? Or I just wonder what's the viability of that kind of an ideology?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, from the department's understanding, there are a variety of companies that have looked at what we might call non-traditional gas electrification options, traditional being the pipeline to South Central, including with an LNG export component. So things like shipping the gas off the slope has been looked at, as well as some other using the gas to make other commodity products, things like ammonia that could be transported in other ways. And I think those companies, there's companies actively looking at those kind of prospects. The state's very interested in entertaining and sharing information about all gas commercialization options. Obviously, AGDC continues to work to bring private sector partners into the Alaska LNG project, large-scale gas line project with an LNG component. So that work is active and is continuing through AGDC, but other opportunities to commercialize gas, get it available to Alaska, and create revenue for the state. Certainly, we're eager to hear about it. And other companies are in concept looking at those.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we're about approaching halfway through our time, so we better maybe tick it up a little faster, guys. So we'll try to hold our questions in the back a little bit. But it's a fascinating subject. It's very important. So I want to make sure we have a good, thorough briefing. So please continue, Mr. Nottingham.
Thank you, Chair McKay, for the record, Derek Nottingham. Now we'll try to expedite these two slides. This is DNR's 2022 cook inlet forecast. It was presented in several committees last year. And just briefly, what this slide represents, the blue flat line that you see across the top there represents that 70 BCF per year demand that is required to power, heat the rail mill, plus a little industrial gas and in-field usage. The bars on that chart represent DNR's forecasts. The blue pieces of those bars represent what we call proved developed. Those are existing wells currently on production and in existing fields. The orange bars represent development wells that need to be drilled in order to meet those volumes. We assumed, based on conversations from quick inlet operators, 15 development wells per year. And so one of the key points here is obviously by 2027, you're starting to see a difference between the supply and demand, and that growing into the future. One of the key assumptions, and it's on the next slide, is that the 15 wells per year we cut off at around 2030. That's basically because of the inventory of known development wells that we understood from the operator has basically diminished. That doesn't mean that they won't find other prospects to drill in their existing lease and won't continue to drill those wells. What they can see into the future was about 15 wells per year for the next 7 or 8 years. This also illustrates the importance of that development well growing, because as you can see, by 2026, 2027, they're more than half of the potential mark. So ongoing development drilling is very important, but it doesn't keep up with the demand. That's the reason we have to really try to push for the known gas discoveries, new gas discoveries to be found and developed in the Cook Inlet. This production forecast does not include any of those known gas accumulations, such as Cosmopolitan or additional development drilling or exploration in Kitchen Lights or those kind of opportunities, nor does it include any hypothetical exploration development in the future.
So I just violate my own speed it up policy, but I just want the committee to really have a good understanding of the situation. You know, we want to have 15 wells per year, which is, I think, about what one jackup can accomplish. So, you can't bring in half a rig, right? So, theoretically, if you had a second jackup, then you could add to that well count significantly. If everybody sees what I'm saying, it's not a difficult concept, but you want to have a full package of drilling for a rig to it needs it needs to fill up its schedule to make it worthwhile to come here. So that's some of the things we're talking about is the possibility of making it creating the incentives where there would be the incentive to bring in a second jackup, which is a significant event to bring in a second jackup to the inlet. But I think that's how we get. I mean, based on my experience, that's how we can fill that gap between that hard blue line and those orange lines, is to add another rig and develop more prospects. Pretty much simple as that. I think that we're kind of, frankly, we're at the point where we, the can has been kicked down the road far enough. And now I think we really need to take action in this building and to put things in place, because it doesn't happen overnight. To bring in a new jackup would probably be a 2 or 3 year, timeline to bring in a rig and have it put it to work, I think, under permitting and procurement and everything. So to fill that gap, we need to get going on some real definite, definite plans. Sorry for my editorial. Just can't help it, Does anybody else got a question?
You didn't get one.
Okay. Representative Mears.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate you bringing your expertise into that, because locations of equipment are significant and can affect many things. I am still trying to get my arms around the requirements in these holders for production, and I know Mr. Kaplan, you and I had a brief discussion about that, but I still don't have in my head what are our requirements from our lease holders, and is there space in there that needs improvement?
question of yours through the chair. When oil and gas leases are a contract between the lessee, the project developer, the resource developer, and the state, and so, you know, there's obligations of both parties. One of the obligations for lessees is to diligently pursue the exploration and development of the resource. And, you know, in the Cook Inlet, for many of our units, they've been in production for decades. Director Nottingham mentioned, we see in our forecast, based on the conversation with operators, plans to continue to spend millions, tens or hundreds of millions of dollars in development expenditure to build even more wells to continue to use those resources. So at an aggregate level, we see a lot of development consistent with the obligation to develop occurring. The department annually for every unit reviews what's called a plan of development, where we see what an operator's plans in the coming year are, what wells, what exploration they plan to do, and we would require to review and approve those. You may have seen some recent plans of development approved by the department include additional requirements and obligations for activities from operators. And so that's our direct kind of first line ability to influence and enforce those commitments, and we are continuing to do so in the argument of the department. At the same time, we do see almost all of our operators very actively at different stages. Some are pursuing financing projects, some have financing and are pursuing particular wells, but there's a lot of development development activity underway that we feel meets those needs.
Okay, now Representative Sandler, a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Probably for John Crowder. When you talk about that future leases in the state equipment basin might be net profit share leases, what's the state experience with those? How many have there been in the 12 basins? I got two follow-up questions on it.
Yeah, Representative Sadler, through the chair, we can provide specific information to the committee, but historically the state did offer net profit share leases on the North Slope. At the time, we offered those with both a net profit share component and a royalty. And the net profit share for those was the big variable, and so different operators in the pursuit of either prospective leases at times offered very high net profit share bids. And so there's existing leases on the North Slope that have both a royalty and a very high net profit share. So we've seen, in a very general characterization, some of those leases proceed to development. The state's benefited from both the royalty and net profit share payments. Some of those leases have not proceeded to development, in part due to the high net profit share bids. And that has been identified as a complexity to developing some of those resources. For the Cook Inlet, we offered our leases without that royalty variable at all. And so we viewed that instead of the state receiving both those streams, we focused on the net profit share so that a developer would be able to recover all their capital investment before sharing profits with the state. And the bid variables that we saw on those leases were much lower, which we believe would potentially allow development of those resources, but as Director Nottingham noted, we didn't see dramatic shifts from historical leasing activity or a high number of new bidders come in as a response to those highly competitive leases. So we want to continue to bring forward other proposals to continue to promote development.
So
follow-up question.
So, I think I hear you saying that your experience with net profit share leases have been limited to the North Slope, and some of them have been successful, some have not, but you're not quite sure why. So do we have, so what confidence might we have that offering those and cooking it are a good way to go? Is this, we're going to have a couple rounds of testing it out first, or any anticipation of what the effect would be of having net profit share leases?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, my very high-level characterization is that while they both feature a net profit share element, the Cook Inlet leases are very different than those North Slope leases because they don't include the royalty element. So and we think that will be highly competitive. One of the dynamics last year, this new proposed lease term was released shortly before our lease sales, and you know we were working to do as much as we could to create an environment that would encourage leasing. But we do believe that if other developers see these lease terms, they may recognize it as a highly competitive opportunity. We just don't know, but we're going to be doing what we can to raise awareness both with existing Alaska operators and outside of Alaska for that we have these kind of opportunities to do.
I think I'll just kind of say for the record, you can see from the tone of our questions that, that we're trying to see what all we can do to try to increase the supply of energy in the Capitol. So, but many flowers to it, let's see what's going forward.
Thank you, Representative.
Okay, I see that there's a break here. This says questions, so any other questions for the oil and gas? Okay, thank you, Mr. Nottingham, very much for your presentation. It looks like we're in our package, there's about 20 pages, and then you go to the Alaska Mining Industry update. Is that correct, Ms. Melanie Worden? Okay, so skip ahead to the slide you see on the screen. And Ms. Worden, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your presentation.
My name is Melanie Worden, Director, Department of Natural Resources, Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. And thank you to the representatives and Chair McKay for inviting me to speak about the Alaska Mineral Industry and give an update for you. This is a 2022 economic benefits of the mineral industry. That's the latest data that's been compiled. 2023 is underway. As you can see, the economic benefits of the mineral industry include $1 billion to 450 local businesses for goods and services, $55 million local and $131 million state government revenue. $266 million in royalty payments to the Alaska Native Corporations, $4.5 million to charitable contributions to approximately 280 nonprofits. The industry has contributed $2.7 million to the University of Alaska and vocational schools for education, workforce development, very important. The industry provides 11,400 total direct, indirect, and induced jobs. The 73% Alaska resident hires at the large mines, and 90 communities across Alaska benefit from jobs with the mineral industry, and essentially $1 billion in wages statewide. Going forward, some caveats for 2023, which will be most of the rest of the presentation. Data and images courtesy of the mineral and exploration companies, but if anything I say here is wrong, it's my fault. The data for 2023 is incomplete because these data have not been published, but they do publish estimates. The resource data is presented in metric units, unless noted, and I'm just going to touch on just a few projects. There's many more that I will mention here that are active. The Alaska mines, there's a typically referred to as a development pyramid, and the projects, you know, there's a lot of them that start out with in the exploration phase, and it costs a lot of money to move a project up into where you define the resources, and then where you get into studies to evaluate the economics, can this move forward? And then you go into permitting, and then it becomes a mine. But as you can see, there's a lot of investment needed to move the project forward, and the large number of exploration at the early stages, it's good to see a lot of that, because then you're moving projects, there's more potential for moving projects up the pyramid, because the odds of developing the mine is really difficult to do that. So most of the presentation today covers the upper part of the pyramid, where you're talking about the mines that are operating, those that are in the permitting stage, and then those that are undergoing economic evaluations, because they've got their resources started to be figured out. And so I'll talk mostly about those, but a couple exploration projects I'll just throw in the highlight.
Representative Rauscher has a short question.
Yeah, I appreciate it. So on page 2, you were talking about workforce development. And what I'm wondering is, in mining, does everybody have to have an education in that type of a field? Or can somebody without that type of an education get a job somewhere in the field, or is it all technical now?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, I did a presentation up in Nome recently, and it's a very wide spectrum. There's so many opportunities across the board, from, you know, there's everybody from providing construction of a camp to food preparation to construction workers to then more of the technical aspects of environmental sampling, and there's There is the full spectrum available.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Representative McCabe has a question. I do. So I slide to again. I just have two questions. I don't see anything on here on the lease payments for the Mental Health Trust for land being leased from the Mental Health Trust. I've seen all this, and I've heard people say, oh, we don't get any money, the state doesn't get any money from mining, from royalties, and yet it appears we do from leases from the Mental Health Trust. So maybe not for now, and I'm not going to ask you the question, but it'd be really interesting to know how much we get, the Mental Health Trust gets in lease payments, say, from UCLA, Kinross, or that sort of thing. And the other thing that's very interesting, and I don't see it on here, is Kinross is, they use 31 megs of power a day. Without their use, the money that ratepayers in Golden Valley would pay for electricity would skyrocket. And I don't think that that's reflected on here. I get it, it's a secondary, tertiary benefit, but for the ratepayers, that would be huge. If Kinross went away right now, the amount that we would pay in Fairbanks to Golden Valley would increase exponentially. And it's a hidden benefit that I think we need to highlight to the general public of some of the benefits that our mining industry provides kind of behind the scenes for us. So anyways, just editorialize it a little bit. But thanks.
Okay, thank you for that, Representative McCabe. Please continue.
Okay. And there are people who actually do track that.
Okay,
so Alaska Mines have, some of them have announced a mine life, and just that's in their news releases or reports. And a mine life is how long a mine will operate with currently known reserves and resources. And, you know, not all mines actually publish this, but this does not mean that the mine will end by that announced date. It's a very common process for mines to right around the mine is the best place to find the next door. And so they continue to expand the resources over time with drilling and additional development work. So when you see that, I just want to kind of give you a heads up there. In Alaska, the production value in 2023, the estimated production value of metals will be $3.686 billion. Statewide, the production of zinc will be 650 to 661,000 short tons of zinc, 126.8 to 132.3 short tons of lead, 715 to 730,000 ounces of gold, roughly 17 million ounces of silver, and roughly 1 million short tons of coal. The details are on the figure for future reference. And so we'll start here at operating mines. Kinross, Alaska operates the Fort Knox mine, and they poured their 9 million ounce of gold on September 27, 2023. They have an open pit mine, and they have 730 direct employees and 300 contractors. Their 2023 expected production forecast is 285 to 295,000 ounces of gold. So on the west side of the figure, the Gilmore Westhead expansion is going to expand their mine life. 2023 development work at Fort Knox included modifying their ore processing mill in preparation for accommodating Manh Choh ore. And I'll talk more about that in a minute. And just what they drilled out is 3.3 million ounces of gold, and they have that in reserve and resource categories as of the end of 2022, and the 2023 numbers will be coming out soon. Okay, Kinross, Alaska nearby has a satellite deposit, the Gill Mine. It's 9 miles east of Fort Knox, and it's in schist as opposed to the granite at Fort Knox. The ore is trucked by, from Gill to the open pit at Fort Knox, and the mining there began in 2021 with an expected 2-year mine life. But again, the mining continues because they've done more work and price gold time. And they are expected to produce, were expected to produce 160,000 ounces, and yet they're still going. So this satellite deposit added 80 to 100 jobs to Kinross's workforce. Coral, go.
Representative Kate.
So I'd like to add a little bit to that. I actually toured Kinross this summer. Think of all the jobs there, all but one live in Fairbanks. And they have a, Kinross is an amazing company. They have a mindset on hiring local, and I actually have a big bar of gold in my pocket. It was kind of cool. Too often we hear about these mines being foreign companies and bringing in workers from the lower 48 and all that kind of stuff. And I think we need to celebrate this mine. It wasn't supposed to be around this long. It was, I think, 5 or 7 years, and it's, what, 27 years or so? It's been around a lot longer than was envisioned, and they are a huge contributor to the Fairbanks economy and local population. And we don't really have any Fairbanks reps in here, so since I toured it, I thought I'd like that. Oh, yeah. Where were you?
Just one. Is that all true what he says, Representative?
Yes.
Sorry. Fact check it right here.
Yeah. Oh, well.
I had that large piece of gold in my pocket,
I know, right?
Too.
That's kind of fun.
I said, better take that tour.
All right. Sorry.
Okay. Representative McCabe. Okay. Please continue, Ms. Ford.
Okay, in southeast Alaska, Core Alaska operates the Kensington Mine. It's an underground mine with Quartz Vein hosted gold. 386 employees, and their 2023 expected production is between 81 and 85,000 ounces of gold. As of the third quarter, they've produced 58,000 already. They're mining the Kensington, Jualin, Raven, and Elmira veins. New ore zone was just discovered, and to keep discovering more ore, they're doing development and exploration drilling. Northern Star Resources is operating the Pogo mine. It's an underground mine, another quartz vein hosted gold deposit. 650 direct employees, and they have 4.5 or 8 million ounces of gold have been mined since 2005. For 2023, as of the third quarter, they have produced 187,837 ounces. Their forecast to produce roughly 250,000 ounces for 2023. And up in the figure there, in the red area, they are concentrating drilling at the Good Pasture target. It's they have a 2022 announced resource of 1.1 million ounces of gold, and this will be a good area to mine going forward in the future. They are focusing on optimization issues to reach a target of $300,000 ounces of gold produced yearly. Hecla Mining operates the Greens Creek Mine in southeast Alaska here. And there's an underground mine that's a polymetallic massive sulfide deposit. There are 495 direct jobs. Their 2023 expected production is between 9.8 and 10 million ounces of silver, and between 55 and 65 1,000 ounces of gold, estimated 47,000 metric tons of zinc, and 17,000 metric tons of lead. They are currently mining in the East Ore Zone and Upper Plate Reserves. They have expanded their reserves greatly in the last few years because of their aggressive development and exploration drilling, and that continues. They've been successful at that. Duck Alaska operates the Red Dog Mine in far northwest Alaska, open pit mines, polymetallic sulfide deposit, 600 direct workers, 700 contractors, big mine, and 52% of all of those workers are non-shareholders, local people. So the 2023 expected production is between 545 and 575,000 metric tons of zinc, between 95 and 110,000 metric tons of lead, roughly 7 million ounces of silver. And in addition to zinc being a critical mineral, they also produce a byproduct, germanium, another critical mineral.
Representative Baker, from your home district.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to highlight this and kind of following up on Representative Rauscher's comments about workforce development, one of the beautiful things about the Red Dog Mine is you have multi-generational workforce there at the mine. You have parents, uncles, aunts. Because of the on-the-job training, you have 18-year-olds coming in at lower level positions, moving their way up over generations. So it's a really interesting way to get the local economy boosted because you have multiple people from the same families, from the same homes, from the same communities. And because of that, they're able to spread out throughout the state to those living in the valley, living in Anchorage, living in Fairbanks. So I just wanted to highlight Red Dog, especially as a former employee, and just how well they've taken the workforce development for that region. Because really, once someone leaves Red Dog, those skills are all transferable as whatever it may be, as an equipment operator, housekeeping, this, that, and the other. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative McCabe.
Thank you. Through the chair, I think, and it's not really for you, or maybe it is for you, but pretty soon they're going to have a world-class fishing river right there because of the fact that they have cleaned up all of the zinc that was in the river because of their care for the environment. So, same thing, we oftentimes read about how Red Dog has got this or that or some dirty because of the EPA requirements, but the proof is in the pudding. You look at the number of fish that are going up that river, and Red Dog is a great steward of our environment, just like all Alaska mines, and I think that that's going to be a world-class fishing river, despite what all the environmentalists say.
Okay, please continue.
Okay, so in southeast Alaska, Sundance Mining Group is operating the Dawson Mine. This is a small-scale underground gold quartz vein system near a hollow on Prince of Wales Island. They initially had their first production in 2019. They have 50 workers there. Their mill averages about 150 short tons per day, and they use gravity separation to extract and concentrate the gold. They have produced 12,821 ounces of gold in 2021, and production levels are similar in 2022 and 2023. Usabelli Coal Mine has been operating since 1943, and from 2021 to 2023, their yearly production has been about 1 million short tons of coal. This coal is used for regional interior Alaska electricity generation. They have a 104-person workforce, and they celebrated it in early September of 2023 by meeting 1,000 days without a lost time accident, and that has continued. This is always something they celebrate at mines. And interesting thing happening at Usabelli is that the University of Alaska and UGJAZZ and industry partners have a Department of Energy's supported grant to examine national critical mineral and rare earth element potential in carbon basins, they call it. But, you know, essentially, you know, at UC Berkeley here, they are examining the stratigraphy and throughout the area to see what the potential might be in this region of Alaska. So.
Okay. Representative McCabe has a question.
So it's not really a question. Again, I can talk for hours about UC Berkeley Mine and what I've observed up there. If you've never been there, take a tour. It's amazing. Joe UC Berkeley has a heart for the environment like nobody I've ever seen before. He understands mining and his mine. Yesterday was 1,135 days since the lost time accident. They had a big barbecue and all the employees got new coats. And that's something really to be celebrated. It does show the care that our mining industry takes not only for our environment but for our people. And you know, it's a shame that previous administrations labeled coal as such a dirty word. I think coal is just now coming of age. In fact, there are UC Berkeley alone knows of 590 years worth of coal reserves at current burn rates for the power plants in Alaska. And it's a it's an amazing resource that we have sort of been ignoring since the early years of President Obama. And the world actually needs clean UC Berkeley coal. It's the cleanest coal in the Western Hemisphere and second cleanest, I think, of anywhere. And we need to highlight that, I think, in all our presentations, not being critical, but trying to highlight. And they're in my district, and I love them. So just had to say that. Sorry.
My daughter used to say, bring on the praise. Okay. Thank you, Representative McCabe. And please continue.
Okay. So in 2023, there was one project that straddled the operating and permitting boundary and that has moved from development into the initiated mining in 2023. That is the Mon Chau mine, and it's operated by Kinross and Pentangle Ore in a 70%, 30% interest ratio. They had their groundbreaking ceremony on August 29, 2023. They're trucking ore on state highway system from Choke to Fort Knox Mill. Their planned production is from 2024 to 2028, and it will be 3,000 tons of ore per day. This has created 280 direct and 205 indirect and induced construction phase jobs. And in 2022 to 2023, there's an error here, not 33, it's 2023. They are anticipated to bring 500 direct and 450 indirect and induced mine operations phase jobs in 2024 through 2028.
Can I ask a question there real quick? We talk about it a lot around here, but I guess I just want kind of a factual report. So they've been trucking the ore from Tope to Fort Knox Mill. That started in August of last year, and then the lawsuit filed. Has that shut down the trucking, or are they shut down, or are they continued operating? Are they continued to haul?
Chairperson McKay, I believe they are continuing.
Still operating.
Yes, I do not know about that.
Okay, I was just curious if where that lawsuit was and if they had been successful in shutting them down.
Not okay. To my knowledge.
All right.
Chairman, thank you. We're happy to confirm for the committee the status of the
location. Okay. All right. Okay, please continue.
Okay, next we'll talk more about those projects that are in permitting or are being studied and moved forward to that stage. The Pebble Limited Partnership is the has the Pebble Project, which is the first or second largest porphyry copper deposit in the world. It, under the studies, the projected 20-year life of mine production would be 6.4 billion pounds of copper, 7.3 million ounces of gold, 300 million pounds of molybdenum, 37 million ounces of silver, 254 short tons of rhenium, and byproduct palladium. In January of 2023, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency issued a final determination under the Clean Water Act, Section 404C, to prohibit and restrict the use of certain waters in the Bristol Bay watershed for use as disposal sites for dredge and fill discharge, which is needed to develop the deposit. July 2023, State of Alaska filed a motion with the Supreme Court to reverse the Environmental Protection Agency's decision. And just in January this year, the Supreme Court declined to hear the case, and we'll just see where this goes from here. So, Donlin Gold operates the Donlin Project. Donlin Gold's a 50-50 partnership between Barrick Gold and Nova Gold Resources. Their studies have shown that that they would intend to operate this as an open pit gold mine, and this project's in the permitting stage. The studies show that under a mine life scenario of 27 years, they would have an annual production of 1.1 million ounces of gold per year. Their proposed budget was $34 million for 2023 field season geotechnical work, hydrologic field work, permitting activities, and mine optimization studies. They've done a lot of drilling in the last couple of years, and they need to sit down and analyze and interpret what it means. A lawsuit was filed in April of 2023 challenging issuing of permits and adequacy of 2018's environmental review by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and results of this are out there waiting to be heard. The Ambler Metals Group is a 50-50 partnership between South 32 Limited and Trilogy Metals, and the Ambler Mining District hosts numerous copper, zinc, lead, silver, gold, and cobalt prospects. The Arctic Project, at the feasibility stage, is the most advanced stage project in the district, but the nearby Bornite Project is at a pre-feasibility stage. At Arctic, the calculated 13-year mine life would have a projected production of 149 million pounds of copper, 173 million pounds of zinc, 26 million pounds of lead, 32,500 ounces of gold, and 2.8 million ounces of silver. This mine project depends on the Ambler Access Project. The next slide here, ADA, for the Ambler Access Project, is proposing to construct a 211-mile controlled-use industrial access road to connect the Ambler Mining District to the Dalton Highway at Mile Post 161. Their 2023 field season for pre-development studies, which would include things like cultural resources, fish, engineering data, they had a $19 million budget, and for the 151 jobs that were created for this, 53 were shareholder jobs. The proposed corridor goes through the gates of the Arctic National Park, but this access through it is guaranteed by ANILCA. It also crosses state and private Native Corporation land, and it crosses federal land managed by the U.S. Bureau of Land Management. The Bureau of Land Management published a final environmental impact statement and a favorable record of decision in 2020, but with rights-of-way granted in 2021 January. Due to ongoing litigation, rights-of-way were remanded, and the BLM initiated a supplemental environmental impact statement for this project. The final supplemental environmental impact statement is expected to be released in the first quarter of 2024 here, and their record of decision is estimated as the second quarter of 2024 to come out. So stay tuned for more news on that from them.
That's true. Okay. Yes, Representative Baker has a question.
More of a comment through the chair. I'd just like to add on to this, one of the important things about the Ambler Access Project and understanding the economics of this part of the state The Ambler, Chumak, and Kobuk communities of the upper Kobuk River are in my district, in my home region, where a lot of my family hails from. And right now, I don't have the exact numbers, but a gallon of gas or a gallon of diesel is anywhere from $10 to $20 in these upriver communities. Some of them have to fly the fuel in by airplane because their river access is so low, barges can't get in during the summer months. And as has been seen from the Red Dog Mine and access from their port road, other villages such as Kivalina and Noatak are able to, over the winter, haul fuel to and from the mine site at different points along the road, and thereby cut their fuel costs sometimes in thirds. So it is really important to understand how these projects affect the local economy and the ability of people to survive, regardless of whether they're working at the mine directly. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Thank you for that, Representative Baker. Okay, please continue.
Okay, on the Seward Peninsula, the company Graphite One has the Graphite Creek project. This project is the United States' largest large flake graphite deposit with more than 10 miles of additional potential they haven't even explored yet. They announced an updated graphite resource in March of 2023. And additional developments here that have happened is that they recently received a $4.7 million U.S. Department of Defense grant for technological development to develop fire suppressant foam. They've received a $3.75 million Department of Defense grant, matching grant, so 50-50, to accelerate publishing a new feasibility study to understand can this be brought further towards possible development. The Bering Straits Native Corporation invested $2 million into this, and they are currently conducting aggressive exploration, and they drilled 57 core holes in 2023, and all of them intersected visible graphite. And their favorite hole, I'm sure, is one that had 27% graphite in one interval. Moving on to statewide exploration expenditures. This is everything from the mines to the little prospectors that are out there doing exploration themselves. The estimated 2023 mineral exploration spending was $230 million. And this goes up and down year to year, you know, due to natural cycles, but it's just down faintly. But John Lynn and some other projects had really huge drilling projects last year, so this is just kind of pretty normal. It's still going well. In statewide, where are people looking and what deposit types? Gold there in the two yellow pie chart bar is the primary exploration commodity, 46% there, and then volcanogenic massive sulfide, polymetallic, Green Creek essentially type deposits were 36%. And then there's exploration in many other deposit types going on in the state, but they're a smaller piece of the pie. So,
Representative Sapp,
if I may disturb the flow for a second, here's an opportunity for the chair to ask the director a question. I've often seen massive sulfide deposits. I think a huge sulfide deposit, but is it a massive sulfide? Does it actually imply it's a big deposit, or is it a massive sulfide deposit? Help the non-geologist, Marcus, please.
Okay, through the chair, Senator Sadler, Representative Sadler. So the massive sulfide is describing, like, in a hand sample, it's really, really high grade, and it's massive sulfide. And so these deposits can be small or big, but it's typically the sulfide in a certain region is massive character.
So it's like a high concentration?
Yes.
So by indication, is there a non-massive or ordinary or a small sulfide deposit?
So like at Red Dog Mine, there's many different ore types, and there's there's ore that is very high grade, massive sulfide. Then the ore that's not quite as high grade is semi-massive sulfide. Then there's other ore types that are veins, and so, you know, it's just a way of characterizing. Yes, it is.
We're dangerously close to a rabbit hole there. I know, once you get talking about rocks, you know, you just can't stop.
That's correct.
Okay, please continue, Ms. Ward.
Okay, in 2023, there were many advanced to early exploration projects. I'm just listing some of the major ones that are on this slide here. I don't want to go into them, but they're statewide, and there's a lot of exciting things happening. That's just basically why I'm putting this in here. These projects, you know, span all the way from the early stage exploration to those are have their permits, and so I'll just go through a couple of these. They're, again, another list of some interesting projects that don't have time to go through, but just want you know that there's a wide range of commodities that are being looked at all across the state. There's a wide range of interests, not just gold, there's everything from, you know, critical minerals to massive sulfides to cobalt and so on. So one of the really big exciting ones is Tepe is conducting exploration in the Red Dog exploration area. And some of the ones that they're looking at is Actigraphic, and Anorak, and Lick. And these are on state land. There are sediment-hosted deposits with significant zinc, lead, silver, and barite resources. And again, like Red Dog, byproduct germanium potential. In 2023, Tech conducted resource definition drilling in all of these projects to understand, need a lot of drilling to understand what the resource really is. Their primary focus is at Tiberic. It's at a scoping level of study. And this would be need to be an underground mine, but their scenarios are to leverage the existing Red Dog mill and sport facilities at the main Red Dog mine. DNR approved their plan of operations for an access road in 2022, and they're waiting for an unfinished environmental assessment and final decision from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Federal Section 106 process and cultural review. And I just kind of want to add one more item about this is that about 5 years ago, Tech announced this discovery at Roundup, and they, in that, if they're drilling, which will be upcoming, if the drilling is demonstrates the ore is continuous and at the grades that they interpolate between drill holes, this is another Red Dog mine. It has significant potential here, and that's why I brought this one up. It's a big deal. So stay tuned for drilling updates from them to hope for continuity of ore and continuation of grade. So in Southeast Alaska near Haines, partners American Pacific Mining and Doa Metals and Mining have a partnership to look at the copper, zinc, silver, gold, barite deposit called Palmer. This project is at a preliminary economic assessment stage. In 2023, they drilled 27 holes to help refine the resource in the south wall resource area in the far up right of the picture. And they also, these projects always do metallurgical studies, so that's ongoing. They're doing geotechnical studies, they're understanding the hydrology of the water, and they're doing environmental baseline studies, and all of this is in support of permitting, and they're, this will feed into them preparing for a feasibility study. And just one more highlight, earlier stage exploration project, Noble Minerals is exploring at Estelle. This is a gold-bearing quartz vein system, Gonic rocks, it's state land in the west central Alaska range. In 2021 to 2023, they've had aggressive large drilling programs at the Corbell and RPM deposits in this trend. They updated their mineral resource estimate in March of 2023, and they're conducting regional exploration on this figure from left to right. There's many prospects that they haven't even looked at yet, so they need to do a lot of work here, but they're getting some interesting results following the news releases. And so, switch topics here, just the Division of Mining, Land, and Water included some slides here, and this is supplemental materials for you to read. Just I'll briefly mention this, and we do have Division of Mining, Land, and Water luckily online, I believe. And do you something you want to add?
Yeah, so Chair McKay for the record, John Strother here, Department of Natural Resources. So we do have our DMLW folks online if there's specific questions from the committee. We really just wanted to provide a little bit of an overview of this slide and then some statistical information on the following slide. But really, for the committee's awareness, that directly where we describe the geologic characteristics of project development, the project, the process. Some of these projects are on state land, some of them aren't. But for our state land, the Division of Mining, Land, and Water manages both the access, the project development, but also plays important regulatory roles for those projects. So this slide summarizes those functions, what we do to facilitate mining on our state land specifically. And you can see that involves coal regulatory efforts, efforts for rehabilitating mine lands, and also just the active management of mining claims, both for large projects and individual. And then, Chair McKay, we'll just very quickly through these final slides.
Okay.
Next slide. Here. So this is a number showing the number of active mining claims. As I mentioned, some individuals may own a claim or two. Some companies may aggregate hundreds and hundreds of claims. And so you can see that the number of claims are in general down from some of the peaks in recent years. But in future slides, we'll see some of the other statistical measurements. And as you would expect, this slide shows the acreage of active mining claims. If the number of claims is down, you expect the acreage to be down. But there are some situations where there could be larger or smaller claims. And you see that this number, the acreage, has ticked up. This next is just a little bit about the closing of mining claims. At times when miners don't provide some of this necessary essential information year by year, those claims are closed. See, in 2016, we had a large number of abandoned claims, and recently we had those. This is a quick slide about mining revenue for the state. You can see in recent years, we've had good revenue numbers, but overall flat, because this is roughly 24.
Sure. Yes, Reverend Sandler, sorry.
Thank you, Chair. This kind of chart always raises questions in my mind, and maybe the public's mind as well. We've seen some reference to previous mining projects or mine projects that have the number of jobs, and we see here this state mining revenue. So I guess, the director, does this include all sources of revenue the state obtains from mining, like mining license tax, coal revenue tax, royalties, permit license fees, lease fees, that kind of stuff? What is included in this and what is not included in the state mining revenue slide?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I think this would be a good question for Steve Buckley, because it's in my mind and water.
Yeah, Mr. Buckley, are you on the line and can you hear us? And did you hear the question?
Yes, thank you, Representative
Sadler.
Sadler, yes, I thought that was you. So the question, for the record, this is Steve Buckley, DNR Mining Section Chief. And yeah, those numbers are claim rental for state mining claims and also for royalties.
State follow up.
Yeah, Mr. Morgan, so it does not include license tax or corporate income taxes, is that correct?
That's correct.
I interested to know just that I often hear from people that the mining does not pay its share, it's not carrying its weight, it's not generating enough money. It does generate more money more than simply just paying rentals and royalties. And it's also got a greater benefit in the state in terms of payroll and local governments, infrastructure development, stability in communities, just many benefits other than just the specific kind of revenue. So I wouldn't mind if I could get the bank rentals and royalty information sometime.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Through the chair, we'd be happy to provide some additional information. And we absolutely agree with you that there's direct revenues, but there's a variety of revenues at the state level, but there's also important local government revenues, community revenues that are a big contribution of my country. So happy to share that. And I believe, Chair McCann, this is our final slide. This is for the application for permits to mine Alaska, the APMAs, which may be a reference. And we see this number trending up, which we view as a very good statistic to see increased activity there. And I know our mining chief is on the line. He can speak to this better than I can. But I think our mining section, particularly in our division, is focused on being responsive, being engaged with industry, processing these applications quickly, but also just being very proactive. So.
Okay, Representative McCabe.
So I'd just like to say thanks for coming and thanks for being a good steward of our state. Too often in the emotion of opposing a mine that's close to you, whether it be whatever the mine is, I'm not even going to mention some of the names because they'll trigger some folks, but we sacrifice the truth in favor of an agenda. And truthfully, in Alaska, if you compare the mines and the way and the care that we take with our environment, I say it all the time, that no Alaskan wants to screw up our Alaska. Nobody wants to do that. And the truth is that we do mining better than anyone else on the planet. We develop our resources better than anywhere else on the planet. And I appreciate the opportunity that you allowed us inside your presentation to sort of highlight that, because it's important. We need to get the truth to the public that some of the things that they see, whether it be a tailings pond in South America and Brazil that fails, the dike that fails, or whatever it is, that's not Alaska. Alaska does things great when it comes to developing our resources, and we need to continue to push that truth out there against the lack of truth that's used to support some of the various agendas. So, thanks.
Okay, thank you, Representative McCabe. Any other questions from the committee? And Representative Armstrong, we didn't hear from you, but I know you're out there. Do you have any final questions?
Nope, just want to thank you so much for your time and for a great presentation.
Okay, thank you. All right, well, thank you for your presentation, Derek and John and Ms. Ward, and very much appreciate it very much. I'm excited about the resource potential Alaska has, and I'm happy to see progress being made to develop all these resources. So, in closing, is there any other business before the committee? Seeing none, I wish you all a very good weekend. Our next committee meeting will be held at 1:00 on Monday, January 22nd, and we are now adjourned at 2:51. Thank you.
Thank you.